Yes, welcome back to the program. We're talking with Daniel Pinchbeck about, well, a great many things, including his vision and his work to develop a transitional plan to have a post-carbon civilization. What it'll look like. And joining with humanity in, you know, coming over this apex. It's really about coming into being. That's really what it feels like. It feels like we're going through these birthing pains of humanity's, you know, coming into a maturity level. Not the last one, but maybe the first one. I know 100 years ago we were still using horse and buggy, so it kind of makes me think we still have a long way to go. And Daniel, let's jump back into it. We had a caller that I think is ready now to go ahead with this question. We're going to go back to Leslie East of the Rockies. Leslie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, right
my
before
actual
the break.
Real question is, yeah. Daniel, I took it, or I assumed from what you were saying that Western civilization didn't really have very many rituals and things. And me, just this is my own personal experience, growing up Catholic with six kids in our family, I saw baptism, First Communion, confirmation, growth in spirituality. This is sort of what I rely on, although I love all the other things that I learn about and read about. I shall go on your website and look at your information. I just wonder, do you discount all those things as opposed to peyote ceremonies in the wilderness or something? And yeah. I'll listen off the air. And Daniel, please get your cough checked out. Get your cough checked out. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Leslie, well, first of all, Rob, thank you for that great introduction to this segment, and I loved what you were saying about the birthing pangs, the coming into being. That was beautifully stated, and it's totally in alignment with how I think about things.
Oh, great, thanks.
And also, I really appreciate Leslie saying she'd check out my work, and I wanted to say that if people are enjoying what we have to say here, I would love it if they would join up for our mailing list at planetaryculture.com, or they can do it on my personal website, danielpinchbeck.net. Now, to get back to Leslie's question, yeah, I mean, I would make a big distinction between rituals, which can be of all sorts. You know, graduation is a ritual. You know, she said baptism, paying taxes is a ritual. I would draw a huge distinction between all those kinds of ritual forms of behavior, what I'm talking about as initiatory experience, which really is, once again, has to involve some method to get people into a kind of a non-ordinary state of consciousness, or what you could talk about as like a transpersonal state of consciousness. And it often requires some types of ordeal, whether it's going into the wilderness and fasting, going on a vision quest, working with shamanic plants, you know, sun dances where people are actually like hung from their pectoral muscles for days. I mean, this is all common to indigenous cultures around the world, that you have to go through these like tough, culturally constructed ordeals to attain adulthood, to attain manhood or womanhood. And part of that is accessing this knowledge for yourself, so it's not just received knowledge. The problem, you know, from my perspective, with something like Catholicism or even Judaism, is it's mainly like received knowledge. Like the priests are telling us what's right and what's wrong. We're not discovering it for ourselves, and we're not accessing the sacred for ourselves. Now, you know, in a way, like, I mean, I've been called like an advocate for psychedelics. It's not exactly how I feel about it. I just think that, you know, they've been very powerful tools for my own development and for a lot of the people that I know. And I think we need to take a full look at what they are and what they do and what the promises they hold. In fact, what's happening right now is a tremendous renaissance and resurgence of research into psychedelics, and particularly into their beneficial and healing properties. So, for instance, Johns Hopkins did a recent study on giving psilocybin, one high-dose mushrooms, you know, that psilocybin is the active constituent in what's called magic mushrooms, giving one high-dose to people who, you know, were adults, who were stable, who never had a psychedelic experience in their lives before. And then they measured them, you know, 6 months after, a year after, 2 years after, gave them a whole battery of tests, and they found that the single mushroom experience, psilocybin experience, had long-term, positive, beneficial impact on their worldview. They felt, most of them, 80% felt it was one of the top five most significant experiences of their whole lives. And even several years later, they registered a strong degree of increase in openness to new experience. So that's really fascinating. They've also been doing studies with MDMA, which is commonly known as the street name of ecstasy, is being used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, in veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan war. They found that even with treatment-averse cases of PTSD, a few sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy can break through, can break the PTSD, and lead to these veterans getting off their medications, you know, starting a new life, and so on. So yeah, so I feel that there is a tremendous difference between all the kinds of ritual that culture creates for us and experiences that are direct, personal, ontological, unmediated, where we experience other states of consciousness or other states of being for ourselves. And that's part of this kind of postmodern renaissance that we're engaged in right now.
Very good. And every answer spawns even more questions. Let's go international. Rob's in Vancouver. You're on with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Wow. Thank you very much for having me on. Got to say, I'm a strong supporter of psychedelics. Mushrooms are everyone should do it.
Okay.
I'm going to be very quick here. And if I'm blunt, I apologize. I made list of points, so I'll be poignant and quick and not take up time. You were asked, you know, about what this all means, you know, when you actually hit the ground. And I have to say, you hummed and hawed a lot. And then it went through a long answer, you know, what I viewed as, you know, spewing a lot of meaningless, you know, quote, notions, you know, just which really doesn't answer that what does it all mean on the ground. I watched a lot of friends go through quote unquote higher education, which shouldn't mean anything. And what I viewed is that was an indoctrination in where they became less objective to the world and became encompassed in all these terms without really becoming saying anything and losing objectivity, losing common sense. Are you really talking about the simple loss of morality, right, and the consideration awareness of those around us? You know, I find sometimes I hear a lot of picking and choosing from different belief systems rather than really encompassing them truly and becoming part of them. I grew up in a Catholic Jesuit system, and I get offended when I hear this, you know, ideas about Christianity, because my experience was anything but indoctrination, and I was constantly pushed to self-explore and experience the world, you know, and not be indoctrinated with, you know, preconceived ideas. So, question being, do you feel that there could ever be a loss of common sense? And you maybe answer the question in terms of, I think there's a loss of connectivity to history.
All right. What do you think, Daniel?
Cool. I mean, yeah, I don't. There was sort of a number of notions and things in there. So just to get to this whole question of religion, you know, although I'm talking about the loss of initiation, the loss of direct experience of the sacred that I believe is necessary to catalyze, higher order kind of evolutionary processes and so on. I'm not dismissing the value of traditional religions. And in fact, I think that if we're going to make the change, the transformation of human society in the time that we have available, traditional religious structures and beliefs, to a certain extent, are going to be very, very important. You know, and in fact, I think those people who are part of maybe like this evolutionary development, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't want to be elitist about it, but people who are kind of like have, you know, kind of cultural creatives, progressives and so on, have made a big mistake in dismissing the traditional religions. And actually what we really need to do is build bridges to them and figure out how we speak, you know, to universally. I mean, I see the traditional religions around the world as, you know, ready-made community infrastructures where you have a lot of good people who care a great deal, you know, coming together in communities of faith and devotion. And, but potentially now we can see if we look at, you know, the developments in science and quantum physics, you know, the stuff we've learned about brain states through meditation, the stuff we're learning about psychedelics in the brain and consciousness and so on. We could potentially have a kind of integration, you know, of science and mysticism that would almost be kind of like a new religious impetus, you know, which might be part of this new mythology that Rob asked me about before. So I know that doesn't answer all of your questions, and I'm sorry if I seem like I'm hemming and hawing. I do the best I can to answer the questions that are put to me in the way that seems right to me at that moment.
There you go. Well, we'll hold it right there. We're going to come back, and we're going to take more questions. You're listening to Daniel Pinchbeck. This is Coast to Coast AM. Keep it right there. Welcome back to Coast AM, talking with Daniel Pinchbeck, and a lot of calls coming in. Let's jump right back into the phone lines on the wildcard line. James is in San Francisco. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Daniel, how are you doing tonight?
I'm having a good time. Thank you.
Awesome. Hey, I just had a couple questions for you real quick. I've been listening for the past hour, and I've been doing actually a lot of research about ancient mythology. And my question for you is, do you think Morpheus was the god of dreams? Long time ago, Morpheus and, you know, Iris, they're gods and goddess. Do you think that Morpheus had the codes to Zion? And my second question is, what are your interpretations of the sacreds? Do you know who the sacreds are? And I'll take everything else off the air.
Thanks so much.
The first question, I have no idea, actually. It's just not even, like, I don't even frame a reference for it. It's just, there's so many, ways people think about stuff these days. The second question, I needed to be clarified or repeated again.
Well, let's see if we can get him back on.
Kind of like, what is the sacred for me or something?
Are you still there? No, he's gone, unfortunately. Okay. He was asking about the sacred. It was pretty open-ended. I was hoping you would have gathered the meaning.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that, there's obviously a lot of books written about this, how cultures create notions of the sacred, whether it's through, time-based ceremonies or places that are given sacred significance and so on. But, I mean, all of that, in a way, I think is, like, just one aspect. And another aspect would be more like, really, if you got into this whole Buddhist idea that samsara is nirvana, that in a sense it's all kind of this, dream manifestation of this cosmic consciousness that's exploring its creative capacities. And in a way, it's all equally sacred. We certainly don't live like that. We've gotten caught in these illusions around work and maybe like false anxieties and so on. What's been very interesting for me is having the good fortune to go visit, cultures like the Kogi and the Arawak people. And, one of the things that really struck me when I hung out with the elders from the Arawak, particularly in the Kogi also, is just the incredible dignity that people have, and also a kind of like a centeredness and a sense that no action they do is hurried or unthought through. And no word is used excessively, So in a way, you felt when you hang out with people like that they're actually living at the sacred, and in a way that's something that's available to all of us. We've just lost the path to it.
Very good. Well, let's go to the first time caller line. John is in Santa Barbara. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you. Just for clarification, Mr. Pinchbeck, you mentioned earlier an anthropologist that hung out with the Hopi. What was the name of that anthropologist, if you know?
Peter Whiteley.
Peter Whiteley. Okay, as you probably know, the Hopi Indians had a prophecy that, we're supposedly at the end of the fourth world right now, and there's a lot of different ways that things can play out. And I've read a little bit about the prophecies, and one aspect is that the people today realize that their leaders are corrupt, that the system's corrupted, and they remake the system. That's one of the Hopi prophecies. So as you may or may not know, there's actually a movement out there right now today in America for an Article 5 convention. And an Article 5 convention over the years has been characterized as, oh my gosh, they're going to get in there and rewrite the Constitution. But really what an Article 5 convention is, it's simply the people building consensus about how we want to move forward. And so I think someone like yourself, if you looked into it a little bit more closely, I think you'll find that the on the ground, what this peaceable reformation of the status quo is going to entail it's going to entail a federal convention of the states in the United States of America. So I just wanted to share that with you and share it with the listeners. And thanks very much for the conversation, guys.
Thanks, John.
John, I would just add to that, like, I don't know the Article 5 thing, and I'll try to remember to look it up, or maybe, you know, shoot me an email to daniel@evolver.net if you want. But, yeah, I'm also interested in, for instance, Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor, lawyer, who developed the whole concept of Creative Commons, has a very interesting campaign running right now called May 1. I believe it's, I want to say May1.us, but if you look at May 1, you'll find it. And essentially, his idea is to aggregate, you know, crowdsource money to create a super PAC supported, you know, purely by the people, which has as its mission to, you know, get you know, the corruption of private money out of public elections. And it looks like a very, very interesting effort. They raised over $1 million in less than a month. Now they're trying to raise $5 million and so on. So, yeah, but I think we'll see more and more of these efforts to, you know, aggregate the mass populace and find ways that we can unify ourselves behind different objectives. I think a lot of times the reason that we don't make the kind of changes that we know need to be made is because we don't believe that our individual action is going to have enough power. But if we knew that hundreds of thousands of millions of other people were going to make the same lifestyle change, you know, for instance, from eating meat to veganism or vegetarianism, you know, I think we would feel we could then, it would be like a multiplier effect. We could then be like, okay, like if 5 million people are going to go vegetarian, you know, I'm going to join that because then I know that that's going to have a significant impact on CO2 emissions, on, you know, animal cruelty, on the conversion of the Amazon rainforest to cow pasture and so on. So, yeah, so I think we could see a lot of potential positive uses of social technologies to help aggregate, you know, the population behind things that we all know need to happen quickly.
Yeah, let's go to the wild card line. Adam's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on. My question was, you were discussing earlier in the show about the necessity for paradigm change and not just a carbonless world, but in our very, I guess, structure systems, for lack of a better term. And, you know, I have a lot of views that I found that are similar with yours. What are some practical steps that we can take in, like, our day-to-day lives to not only promote, say, maybe a carbon-free existence, but to promote the paradigm shift into a more, as you said, chaotic or fluid system of working with each other?
Good question.
That's a great question. And, I mean, I made an effort to answer that question through my last company. I had a company called Evolver.net. We published a web magazine, RealitySandwich.com, which is still going. We also spawned a nonprofit, EvolverNetwork.org, where you can go and check it out and sign up if you want. And we were really looking at the idea of creating a community infrastructure for people who were recognizing the severity of all these issues and wanted to create a transformational approach or culture. So we created a template where we'd have these monthly meetings with groups across the whole network that could be around permaculture or shamanism or bioremediation or alternative economic systems. And in some cases, some of these groups actually, you know, spawned kind of alternatives, either little, you know, agriculture communities came out of it, or in some cases, alternative currencies came out of it. Like the group in Baltimore helped architect something called the B-Note, which is now a currency there that's used to keep money flowing through local businesses and so on. So, yeah, so that was my first answer was the Evolver Network, which, you know, maybe still has like 40 or 50 groups worldwide and actually seems to be growing right now. So that's one way. Another, there's a bunch of groups like that, and it really depends on individual taste. Another one is Transition Town. That was a movement that was started in the UK based on permaculture principles and applying those principles to how you'd get social society organized to face things like peak oil and climate change. And their idea is that first you have to, you know, get the good information to people by creating teach-ins, by showing films, having kind of, you know, opportunities to come together and you know, reckon with the information, and then go into engagement on the local level. So, for instance, you know, if a town found out that, you know, a lot of its food or fuel was coming from you know, some part of Central Africa that was engaged in a lot of genocides and wars, they could choose to, you know, pressure their local, you know, city to redirect, you know, how it's using the funds and so on.
Right. Well, hold it right there, because we got one more half hour coming up with our guest, Daniel Pinchbeck, and your questions. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Keep it right here. We'll see you right after the break. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM, and this is the last half hour with Daniel Pinchbeck. His website, his books are all linked up right now at Coast to Coast AM. And I say we jump right back into it. Daniel, there has been an explosion of interest and phone calls on the line. So why don't we jump over to the first time caller line, and we'll talk to Wyatt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Rob, Daniel, good morning.
Morning.
First thing that I want to say is I'm not big into drug usage myself, but I'm very libertarian in my beliefs. I think just as a point of saying that we just ought to legalize them all. We ought to benefit from the tax revenue we can take off of. And I think it's refreshing to hear somebody who's proposing the usage of these. And I guess from your perspective, Daniel, they're more traditional ways, but for mine, they may be less traditional. But I think it's refreshing to hear somebody proposing it. But I got to say, Daniel, man, I take a lot of issues with a lot of the things you're pushing out there. I think that now I got to say, and I'm going to be honest, I didn't catch it from the beginning. So if I'm making any assertions or assumptions that are incorrect, please, by all means, let me know. But what I'm taking from it is an assertion of, and there's a lot of contention going on in this right now in political circles and just in the media in general, of a man-made global warming. And the science doesn't support it, and I don't think that can be argued. I think that there's been a lot of, and especially considering this is Coast to Coast AM, man. You guys are all about conspiracy. The biggest thing going on right now is the government deception about this man-made global warming. It's a complete fiasco, and they're doing it to exert control over us. And I just, Daniel, I'd like to get your input on that. I mean, obviously, from what I've taken, you support global warming as a general thesis. I don't know your support of it as man-made or not.
Okay. It seems that, you know, from everything that I can understand, and I understand there's a lot of contention around this, and conspiracy theories and so on, I have to feel that, I sort of feel that a lot of this at this point is a little bit, how can I say, a little bit, you know, more based on our, I don't know, on you know, in a sense, you know, kind of media companies, you know, and kind of outsider media to, you know, desire to get attention and sometimes ratings and so on, that actually the science on climate change is pretty significantly set. Like the vast preponderance of scientists around the world now say that, you know, human activity, human industry is having a massive effect on the biosphere. And, you know, for instance, not only are we, you know, pushing, I can't even remember the exact, I think it's a million tons of CO2 per hour or something. It's like, I don't know, it's just an incredible amount into the atmosphere. You know, we know, for instance, that the oceans are absorbing the excess CO2 that we emit. You know, so we have ocean acidification as a problem that's almost as bad as climate change, where the oceans are now, I think they've become 30% more acidic in the last 40 years, which is leading to the breaking down of the, you know, the coral reefs and so on. And this is totally has to do with industry, like the CO2 that our industries and our cars are emitting. So it's totally, you know, based on nothing but hearsay and a desire to believe that one often has, like, something over the authorities or whatever to think that this is not happening. And I think that somehow we have to get beyond this stage of wanting to doubt. And, you know, we know there's a lot of disinformation from the fossil fuel companies and so on, which have added to the chaos. You know, we can look around. We can see, you know, that we're emitting, you know, tremendous amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. You know, and we can see if we talk to our parents or our grandparents, you know, how deep the changes are to significant to the environment. You know, whether it was like my mother when she was a girl, you know, the Hudson River would freeze over and they could walk on the river or walk across it. You know, that hasn't happened in my lifetime. You know, when I was a kid, you know, in Central Park, you know, lakes used to freeze over so that people could skate on them. You know, that hasn't happened in my daughter's lifetime. You know, so So, yeah, so I think, like, there's such a clear preponderance of evidence. You could read so many books, whether it's Elizabeth Colbert or, you know, all these books that are just, you know, making it patently obvious that climate change is happening and that it's a human-made phenomenon. Now, the climate system is extremely complex, so we've also learned that climate change, or what would be a trend towards warming, you know, causes a lot of perturbations, and in some cases could even lead to, like, a mini ice age or cooling, or the winter in New York was certainly extremely cold, but that doesn't, you know, kind of take away from the larger aspects of what we're discovering, that the CO2 that we're emitting in the atmosphere is interfering with, you know, the sun that's hitting the Earth, and is therefore changing, you know, the whole cycle of what's happening on the planet. You know, so yeah, I mean, I guess that's my stance. I, you know, from everything I've read and tried to understand, that's the best that I can do as a person.
Okay, let's pause it right there. The rest of your phone calls right after this quick break. All right, welcome back to Coast AM, and Daniel Pinchbeck is our guest, and you've made it. I wasn't sure there for a while. You're kind of almost losing your voice there for a minute or two. But
it's
you
true.
Made...
I recovered. Found my steady state.
I know. It's like night and day. I was sending you healing energy, too.
Thank you.
For what it was worth. Well, okay, let's jump back to the phone lines. Let's go back to Canada. Love Canada. And we're talking to Tom. Hey, Tom, welcome to Coast.
Hey, yeah, it's nice to meet you. I'm excited to talk to Daniel. I was listening earlier, and I was really digging on some of the things he was saying, but I have a question for him. Well, actually, it's kind of two parts. One is, I'm really with you when you're saying that we all kind of need this shift in thinking, but I want to know, what do you think is the spark that's going to get more than just, you know, the kind of cliques and the kind of groups that are together now? What's going to be the spark that's going to make it, you know, kind of affect millions of people to change their thinking instead of just the small pockets that we're seeing now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know the answer. I don't think anybody can know the answer. I mean, when tipping points happen, I mean, we have to look at things like the fall of the Berlin Wall, right? Like, 1989, like, you know, even though, you know, there were think tanks and you know, institutes that paid millions of dollars to people to look into the future and research, you know, what would happen with the Russia and communism, almost nobody had predicted that the Berlin Wall was just going to be taken down, you know, by the people themselves without a violent reprisal. You know, so sometimes, you know, things happen, like consciousness is changing subliminally, and we don't know when there's going to be an emergence, you know, into kind of action and event. In this case, it would probably be a combination of, you know, more disasters leading to a kind of tipping point realization that the system as we have now is not going to, you know, do the job. Now, at that point, it's going to be kind of like what they talk about in chaos theory as, you know, basins of attraction. You know, one basin of attraction will lead to despotism, you know, desperate efforts to control the remaining resources, you know, kind of, you know, armed to the teeth, you know, et cetera, you know, characters kind of grabbing on for dear life while a lot of, you know, poor people are disenfranchised, go hungry and so on. You know, and the other option, you know, is, you know, I mean, well, I guess is towards developing a new cooperative infrastructure so that we all work together for the benefit of all. You know, Buckminster Fuller was one of the people who really foresaw this this point in his book Utopia or Oblivion, and he really felt there was just, you know, two possible trajectories for humanity. Either we would continue a system based on, you know, social injustice, economic inequality, and ecological destruction, and we would ultimately not survive as a species, or we would make this transition into collaboration and cooperation and efficient use of resources, potentially a universal subsidization where we guarantee everybody on Earth, you know, the basic, you know, living capacity. So that we, you know, we could make this shift into, you know, what Fuller, you know, called a utopia, which is a big word, but I would say more like a regenerative system design.
Great. Well, let's go back to the wild card line. John is in Louisville, Kentucky. Thanks for holding.
All right, guys. Thank you very much, Daniel. You've done a great job, and you were so diplomatic with that last caller. Now, I am a person who has built electric cars my entire life. I was one of the first 18-year-old firefighters in Louisville, Kentucky. I had to operate a gas-powered generator on the fire department. I'm now building an electric car that is powered by a wheelchair motor. And it's so great to know that there are still some young people out there who do know that you do not get to choose the law of physics. The temperature of global warming is 33 degrees. The temperature of global cooling is 32 degrees. No matter what you think, the ice is going to melt at 33, and the water is going to freeze at 32. Now, one of the questions I was going to ask you is, how can the president help put this issue out here? I've already thought about contacting the president to see if he can sign a presidential order to legalize electric golf carts for people who are not on the interstate, but just to make them street legal. And this debate about global warming is so annoying to me. Could you just address that and give us some other ideas of how the president could sign an order that could help us deal with cleaning up our air? Because we all know this is reversible. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
John, I don't know if I have a great answer for you. I mean, I feel that, like, you know, to be president of a country like the United States requires a huge series of compromises. And underlying those compromises is the sort of, you know, dictum of the means justify the ends. You know, so if you have to take a series of, you know, compromises, you know, make a whole series of deals with people, you know, and so on, at a certain point, you're so compromised that you're not really capable of acting, you know, with clarity and you know, emphatic energy in a way. You know, this is why, I mean, you know, the Occupy movement maybe had a number of issues and problems, but kind of going back to they're basing some of their ideas on, like, the Gandhi movement and this whole idea of a prefigurative politics where you don't have to see the means justifying the ends at all. You have to see that the means and the ends need to be the same. You know, so for me, I wouldn't hold out a lot of hope for the president to be doing too much unless there was, you know, a large-scale civil society movement that was pressuring the White House. Or, you know, what's also possible is that a lot of these people are going to start snapping to their senses and recognize that, you know, the system is sort of set on self-destruct right now, and they need to, you know, quickly encompass a lot of new perspectives and approaches and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's more likely to come from a civil society movement that begins with the individual who recognizes that, you know, if we care for the future health of our, you know, children and grandchildren, maybe even ourselves on the young side, you know, we have to contribute, you know, in any way we possibly can to bringing about this change in the next decade.
John brought up this idea about electric cars, and I wonder, the landscape that's out there, how do you see it? Do you see that there's some really viable cars, or do you still think these things are, I don't know, not quite ready for prime time?
So once again, I'm not an electrical engineer, but I do have some friends who report back to me on this stuff. And, you know, my understanding is that the technology has advanced and evolved to the level where, you know, within 10 or 15 years, we could transition to a totally renewable-based system, mm-hmm. where people are able to create their own energy and feed it back through, you know, what some people talk about as the Internet of Energy, you know, to the grid. This is an idea that Jeremy Rifkin developed in his book, The Third Industrial Revolution, which is a really, I think, profound and powerful, you know, realization.
Mm. Well, they have these cars that get, I mean, Ford sells cars, regular sedans. They get 60, 70 miles to the gallon. They're not diesel. They're just made the engines a certain way, but they sell them for England. And the rationale is, oh, well, you know, gas is so expensive over there. They need a car that can, you know, do very well in the economy. But for some reason, they can't sell them in America. Do you still see that there is so much opportunity squandered on these regulations and this, I don't know, entanglement of corporate nonsense?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's totally obvious, right? I don't think we could possibly see it any other way. But once again, there's the possibility of social technologies, mm-hmm. you know, leading to efficient sharing, you know, of resources, you know, where, like, you know, instead of having to buy a new drill or a new vehicle or something, you can share it with people around you.
Yeah, I like the Fisker. I'm really bummed that car company went out of business. It was...
I, I did want to mention also, I mean, I don't know if people have heard the new news from Tesla, which is apparently they're making their electrical engines. They're opening the patents up.
Yes.
Anybody can make use of them or innovate from them.
Yeah.
A friend of mine was just at the Sustainable Brands Conference in California, and he said similarly Coca-Cola has been developing a bottle that's non-destructive, maybe plant-based and so on. And similarly, they've open-sourced the sort of chemical composition and design of that bottle. I haven't checked this through myself. It's my friend telling me.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, both those things would suggest, once again, that even within the corporate structure, there's this realization that we have to move from the old protective, kind of copyright mindset to more of sharing the valuable knowledge and information so that more and more people can grab the templates and model themselves after them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hopeful technology out there. I mean, the people are making cars that are running on compressed air. Some of them, like the Fisker I was mentioning before, it's a great car. It's an electric car, but it had a gas generator on it. Now, the gas generator wasn't connected to the wheels. It simply made more electricity. So you could drive this thing, forever. As long as you had gas, you could go light years, and you wouldn't have to stop after 7 hours and park it for 14. I mean, it just seemed like a...
Yeah, I just want to say there's all sorts of technologies that, mm-hmm. that would be very helpful.
Yeah.
A lot of them are based on Buckminster Fuller principles. You could look at the BFI.org, the Buckminster Fuller Institute, their annual challenge grant, where you see all these people who have really come up with a lot of amazing ideas and processes and techniques. For instance, things like biochar, which is actually, once again, based on indigenous practices in the Amazon of slow burning biomass to create a carbon rich tilth that could restore soil. So now people have created biochar kind of gasifiers where you burn biomass to create energy, but the sort of effluent or the out product is the final product is a tilth that's nutrient nitrogen rich that you can put into soil to increase soil.
Mm, great. Well, we're just sort of coming to the final throes of the interview. Tell us what's on your radar for the next year.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much, Rob, for having me. I really appreciated, everything about the show and the questions and everything. I mean, for me, there's a few projects that we want to do with the Center for Planetary Culture, planetaryculture.com. And one of them is this initial research project that will be a living document in a wiki around how this strategic transition could happen. We're interested in a number of other kind of projects we'd like to do, including a web magazine, and then also research into kind of how media and technology could be used to accelerate kind of awakening of consciousness, presence, make people less, immediately reactive, to circumstance and able to take kind of a more non-attached or bigger picture. I mean, I think one way we could look at our situation on the planet right now, it's like a race between the amygdala, which controls our fear, flight, and flight response, and the neocortex, which allows us to sort of plan, to get kind of attached from immediate emotional responses, and to kind of act in a more encompassing or comprehensive manner. So hopefully the neocortex is going to win out, and I'll do what I can with my limited resources to support that process.
Great. And where would you like the people to find you on the web?
So I'd love it so much if people who like this interview would sign up at danielpinchbeck.net to get my mailing list. They can also sign up at planetaryculture.com. And we've got a donation button on planetaryculture.com if people want to contribute so that we can, move faster on our agenda and bring these things into fruition.
Great.
That would be amazing also.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you. And thanks for everyone for listening. And allow me once again to be with you on another Saturday night. And I welcome all of your questions and comments and hope to see you real soon. Have a great night. And thank you for listening. This is Coast to Coast AM.